I mean,
some of the scenes you will witness may appear to border on fantasy.
I can game it in a big way.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Yes, yes. But,
I mean, tonight,
we care, and it shows.
The law.
Of course. You will listen and obey.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Welcome to another edition of Media Monarchy. My name is James. You're listening to the Portland Radio Authority. It's Friday, December 22nd, 2006. This is the seventh episode of Media Monarchy. And you can go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for all the news and stories we're going to cover today. Tons of stuff to go over. Everything from Cheney taking a stand to the Good Shepherd and Clinton advisors hiding 9/11 documents and the draft and terrorist attacks and bioterror and Jeb Bush. But we're going to get things started off right. Play it how I'm feeling. We're going to listen to Gil Scott-Heron, Winter in America. And you're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority.
Thank you very much. For the last few years, we have been doing a song that concerns the fact that the seasons have been affected recently. Don't seem to have spring like you used to, or summer or fall. It has been a season collectively of frozen aspirations and frozen hopes. We'd like to do a song for you about the season that we're trying to get over. It's called Winter in America.
Paper, and with free society, well,
struggle, but they died in vain. And now democracy is ragtime on the corner of unemployed and I'm hoping that it rains. Yes, it's been a hoping for some rain, but it just don't look like rain. I've seen the robin first in Barron's house, the watching last is a race ahead, marching across the floor. The winter, it's coldest winter in America. Yes, it's a time when all of the young brothers who can help us done better and care. They put them in jail. Hey, even though it's something wrong, everybody wants to know. Like winter in America. Yes, well, truth is there ain't nobody fighting because, well, nobody knows what to say. Yes, well, the truth is nobody fighting because, well, nobody knows. And
It's Gil Scott-Heron with a live version of Winter in America, kicking it off, the seventh episode of Media Monarchy. You're listening to the Portland Radio Authority. You can go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for all the news we're going to cover today, this December 22nd, 2006. Top of the news today, this just broke when I got up this morning and saw it, Selective Service Plans Readiness Tests for Draft. This is coming from KOMO-TV out of Seattle. The Selective Service System is making plans to test its draft machinery in case Congress and President Bush need it, even though the White House says it doesn't want to bring back the draft. The agency is planning a comprehensive test, not run since 1998, of its military draft systems, a Selective Service official said. The test itself would not likely occur until 2009. Scott Campbell, the service's director for operations and chief information officer, cautioned that the readiness exercise did not mean the agency is gearing up to resume the draft. "We're kind of like a fire extinguisher. We sit on a shelf," Campbell told the AP. "Unless the president and Congress get together and say, turn the machine on, we're still on the shelf." Veterans Affairs Secretary Jim Nicholson prompted speculation about the draft Thursday when he told reporters in New York that society would benefit if the U.S. were to bring back the draft. Later, he issued a statement saying he does not support reinstating a draft. The administration has for years forcefully opposed bringing back the draft, and the White House said Thursday that policy has not changed and no proposal to reinstate the draft is being considered. The trick is they probably won't call it a draft. They'll call it national service or universal service. So keep the word national service on your brain. So whenever you see that, you know they're talking about a draft. So when they say no draft, no, it's not a draft. It's service. It's not torture. It's pressure. It's, I don't know. I grabbed today's Oregonian off the bus on my way here. Headline, 8 Marines charged in killings. The case over the deaths of 24 Iraqi civilians in 2005 is the largest to emerge from the war. 40 U.S. Marines were charged yesterday with murder in connection with the deaths of 24 men, women, and children last year in the Iraqi town of Haditha, and 4 officers were charged with failing to make accurate reports and thoroughly investigating the deaths. The November 19, 2005 incident in the insurgent stronghold in the Euphrates River Valley is one of several in which U.S. personnel face criminal charges in the deaths of innocent Iraqis. But the Haditha case is regarded as the most serious, both because of the numbers of victims and Marines involved, and because the Marine Corps initially said the civilians had been caught in fighting between insurgents and U.S. forces. The most serious accusations were leveled against squad leader Staff Sergeant Frank Wuterich, who allegedly murdered 12 people and ordered Marines under his command to, quote, shoot first and ask questions later, in a sweep of homes that led to 6 more deaths. The Marines allegedly went on a rampage after a roadside bomb exploded beneath a Humvee in their convoy, killing Lance Corporal Miguel Terrazas and injuring 2 others. Jumping on Cheney to take the stand in the Plamegate case. This is coming from Raw Story. A segment on CNN broadcast discussed Vice President Dick Cheney's planned testimony as a defense witness in the Justice Department's perjury case against former White House aide Louis Scooter Libby. CNN broadcaster Soledad O'Brien remarked that it can be kind of confusing, but that the big takeaway from this is the VP is on the stand. CNN correspondent John King noted that Cheney's testimony could be potentially politically damaging.
Soledad, back to you.
All right, Chad, thank you. It's going to be Vice President Dick Cheney for the defense, his former chief of staff on trial. Closer look this morning as lawyers for Louis Scooter Libby say they plan to call the vice president as a witness in Libby's perjury trial. The trial's all related to the leak that exposed the identity of the CIA operative Valerie Plame. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is chief national correspondent John King. Good morning, John. Nice to see you, as always. Soledad. You know, many people expected that, in fact, Cheney would be called for the prosecution, and he was not. Kind of a surprise to see him called for the defense. Isn't this incredibly, potentially, politically damaging for the vice president to be called and be on the stand?
Well, it sure could be. And what makes this so interesting is this is the same vice president who went all the way to the Supreme Court to fight court orders that he released documents from his secret energy task force, someone who has vigorously defended the secrecy of the administration. Yet he will be on the stand discussing very high-level meetings of the Bush White House about how they responded to Iraq war criticism. But here's the interesting part. Mr. Cheney is not only going to do this, he's willing to do this, according to sources close to the case. I talked to him a few months back, and he wouldn't talk about the case because he knew then he might be called as a witness. But listen to him defend his former chief of staff, Scooter Libby?
I'm not going to comment on the case. I may be called as a witness. Scooter Libby, obviously, one of the finest men I've ever known. He's entitled to the presumption of innocence, and I have not made any comments on the case up till now, and I won't.
So, Soledad, quite a turnaround for this vice president. He is willing to do this because he wants to help his former top aide, but you're right, high-stakes legal and political drama.
All right, so what does Scooter Libby need the vice president to say on the stand to help him out?
What Libby's defense is that if he lied to investigators, if things he said were not true, it's not because he was deliberately lying, it's that he was overwhelmed. That he is, many people say, Scooter Libby was to Dick Cheney as Karl Rove is to George W. Bush. That he was so busy, so involved in all the national security issues going on at the time, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, that if he said things that were not true, he simply misspoke, he had faulty memory, he was not deliberately lying. That is the point he needs Dick Cheney to make for him on the stand.
Is the public going to get a chance to see the vice president on the stand? I mean, is it going to be televised? Will there be pictures?
There will be no pictures because this is a federal courthouse, but it is a fascinating opportunity. You mentioned the prosecution decided not to call the vice president, but once he is on the stand, they will get to ask him questions. And one of the key exhibits in this case could be the vice president's own hand-scribbled notes. Remember, this all started when former Ambassador Joe Wilson wrote a column in the New York Times saying the president exaggerated the case for war. Then the White House launched an aggressive effort to rebut Mr. Wilson, to discredit him. Those are Dick Cheney's scribbles on that, essentially saying, did his wife send him on a boondoggle? Valerie Plame was his wife, she was the CIA operative. So the facts can be confusing if you haven't followed it closely. But again, the vice president of the United States will be on the stand in federal court. No cameras because the cameras aren't in there, but it will be part of the public record.
You know, it can be confusing even if you have kind of followed it closely. But you're
yes,
right. At the end of the day, the takeaway is the VP on the stand and everybody's going to be talking about it even if they don't get a chance to see it. Chief National Correspondent John King for us this morning. Thanks, John, as always.
Thank you.
Yeah, obviously the vice president willing to make a big commitment for his former chief of staff there.
So come January, there's going to be a dick on the stand. I believe that's when it'll happen, January. So keep your ears peeled for that one. Speaking of the CIA, there's a new film that opens today, directed by Robert De Niro, and it's called The Good Shepherd. The value of secrecy, commitment to honor and discretion has been embedded in Edward Wilson, played by Matt Damon, since childhood. As a dedicated, optimistic student at Yale University, he is recruited to join the Order of Skull and Bones, a secret society designed to breed the world leaders of tomorrow. Wilson's acute intelligence, immaculate reputation, and sincere belief in American values render him a prime candidate for a career in intelligence. During the Second World War, General Sullivan, played by De Niro, recruits him to the new Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, a precursor to the CIA. As one of the office's covert founders, duplicity is required of Wilson as he navigates a world where nothing can be accepted at face value. Over his 30-year career, Wilson's methods are adopted as standard operating procedure, and he becomes a respected veteran in his field, but his idealism is eroded by a growing suspicious nature, reflective of a world settling into the long paranoia of the Cold War and an escalating conflict with his volatile KGB counterpart. In the end, he sacrifices everything in the name of serving the country he loves, including his devoted wife, Clover, played by Angelina Jolie, and his children and himself.
Everybody has secrets to tell. My secrets are bigger than others.
And you understand that whatever we discuss here doesn't leave this room.
Of course.
The president has asked me to look into creating a foreign intelligence service.
My orders came through. I'll be going overseas.
What are you going to do, Edward? Save the world?
I'll do what I can.
Welcome to our little clubhouse. You're going to have to learn the English system of intelligence.
I'm here to see a tailor. How is the fishing?
Set the mongoose free.
Gentlemen, this is CIA.
That's a nasty little secret.
No matter what anyone tells you, there'll be no one you can really trust.
In our profession, it's best that way.
How do I know if I can even trust you?
You can take the gloves off.
Tell me your real name.
We don't have to be gentlemen anymore.
What is your name? You're the guys that scare me. You're the people that make big wars.
And we make sure the wars are small ones.
First opportunity you boys get, you're going to be breaking and entering like thieves in the night.
Margaret tells us that you work with the CIA.
My wife has a vivid imagination.
You are never to tell anyone what it is that I do.
What you do? I don't know what you do. You leave at 5, you're home at 10, 7 days a week. I live with a ghost. I don't know anything about you.
Why is it that people like us choose to serve for nickels a day, a profession that makes us continually look over our shoulders for who's watching us.
It isn't about dedication and loyalty. It's about belief in what we do.
I've never even met my little boy.
Are you Edward?
We don't have to be like this, you and I. We don't have to be strangers.
Remember what I said to you about friends?
Get out while you still can, Edwin. While you still have a soul.
The Good Shepherd.
So that's the trailer for The Good Shepherd, opening today in theaters everywhere, I guess. I guess it's nice to think that there's lots of people going for a Christmas movie, and they'll learn about Skull and Bones and secret societies and CIA Black Ops. Oh, speaking of CIA Black Ops, brings us to our next story. Clinton's security advisor hid 9/11 documents, coming from the Associated Press. President Clinton's national security advisor removed classified documents from the National Archives, hid them under a construction trailer, and later tried to find the trash collector to retrieve them, the agency's internal watchdog said Wednesday. The report was issued more than a year after Sandy Berger pleaded guilty and received a criminal sentence for removing the documents. Berger took the documents in the fall of 2003 while working to prepare himself and Clinton administration witnesses for testimony to the September 11th Commission. Berger was authorized as the Clinton administration's representative to make sure the commission got the correct classified materials. Berger's lawyer, Laney Brewer, said in a statement that the contents of all the documents exist today and were made available to the commission. But Representative Tom Davis, a Republican from Virginia, outgoing chairman of the House Government Reform Committee, said he's not convinced that the archives can account for all the documents taken by Berger. Davis said working papers of National Security Council staff members are not inventoried by the archives. There is absolutely no way to determine if Berger swiped any of these original documents. Consequently, there is no way to ever know if the 9/11 Commission received all required materials, Davis said. Moving on, coming from ABC News, London braces for attack. Miracle if there isn't one. British intelligence and law enforcement officials have passed on a grim assessment to their U.S. counterparts. Quote, it will be a miracle if there isn't a terror attack over the holidays in London, end quote. The senior American law enforcement official tells ABC News, British police have been quietly carrying out a series of key arrests as they continue to track at least six active plots tied to what they call Al-Qaeda of England. Officials said they cannot cite any specific date or target, but said Al-Qaeda had planned previous operations during the Christmas holidays that had been disrupted. It's not a matter of if there will be an attack, but how bad the attack will be, an intelligence official told ABC News. Authorities say they are seeking at least 18 suspected suicide bombers. They hope they are one step ahead, but they seriously fear they may be one step behind, the senior American official said. British law enforcement and intelligence officers say the ongoing plots have been in the planning stages for at least 3 years. The officials say the plots are all connected and track back to Al-Qaeda commanders in Pakistan who have been recruiting and training British citizens of Pakistan descent. A report by Newsweek says that American Al-Qaeda figure Adam Kadan, also known as Adam the American or Azam the Operative, has served as a translator of a 12-member team of Western recruits. The English brothers said to be preparing an attack that would be much bigger than last year's attack on the London subway system. U.S. officials say the Newsweek report is, in many respects, parallel to intelligence reports they have been receiving. British Home Minister John Reid recently told reporters that it was highly likely that terrorists would attempt an attack before the first of the year.
Tonight we go to a place where Al-Qaeda recruits terrorists. The place is seemingly peaceful, but it is also fertile ground for militants to recruit terrorists willing to carry out attacks against the U.S. and Europe. Our chief investigative correspondent, Brian Ross, joins us. Brian?
Charlie, Al-Qaeda's ability to find new recruits is of great and growing concern to U.S. and European officials. And as we found in an ABC News undercover investigation, much of that recruiting is taking place in Pakistan. This is one of the places where U.S. and Pakistani officials say al-Qaeda has been able to find new recruits. A yearly gathering in a field held this week outside Lahore, Pakistan, attended by more than a million religious, conservative Muslims who belong to a group that opposes violence. But intelligence sources tell ABC News al-Qaeda uses the setting as cover.
It's where they, every year, they send operatives to recruit people, to raise funds, and to plot attacks against the West.
Pakistani officials say some of the al-Qaeda meetings have taken place in a building compound on the grounds, where access is closely guarded. ABC News consultant Alexei Deba took these pictures as he worked his way into the compound this week. It was here 2 years ago, in November 2004, that intelligence sources say two of the London subway bombers met with al-Qaeda commanders.
This is kind of the heart of this whole terrorist activity on the site. It's this compound.
The gathering this week comes against a backdrop of raging anti-American sentiment in Pakistan, particularly following an airstrike last month on an Islamic school suspected of training terrorists in northern Pakistan. 80 people were killed in the attack, and the former CIA station chief in Pakistan fears al-Qaeda will use it to its advantage.
The risk associated with groups that are based in Pakistan is always very high, and they're obviously, this sort of recruitment, one can presume, is taking place all the time. But after something like this has occurred, I would say that the opportunities for recruitment are that much greater.
Gentlemen, we have called you together to inform you that we are going to overthrow the United States government.
You still think that jet fuel brought down the World Trade Center? Does anybody else see a problem here? If the government has nothing to hide, why are they so afraid to answer a few questions? This story does not add up.
Live on a mission to never forget. We are the people that I've never met.
Ministry with Lies, Lies, Lies off their latest record, Rio Grande Blood, featuring samples from Loose Change, and asking you if you still think Jet Fuel brought down the World Trade Center towers. That song, interestingly enough, is nominated for a Grammy. So 9/11 Truth is up for the Grammy nomination. So we'll see. You're listening to Media Monarchy. My name's James. It's December 22nd. This is our seventh episode. Next story is coming from truthout.org. Bush developing illegal bioterror weapons for offensive use. In violation of the U.S. code and international law, the Bush administration is spending more money in inflation-adjusted dollars to develop illegal offensive germ warfare than the $2 billion spent in World War II on the Manhattan Project to make the atomic bomb. So says Francis Boyle, the professor of international law who drafted the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989 enacted by Congress. He states the Pentagon, quote, is now gearing up to fight and win biological warfare, end quote, pursuant to two Bush national security directives adopted without public knowledge and review in 2002. The Pentagon's Chemical and Biological Defense Program was revised in 2003 to implement those directives endorsing first use strike of chemical and biological weapons, CBW, in war, says Boyle, who teaches at the University of Illinois Champaign. Terming the action the proverbial smoking gun, Boyle said the mission of the controversial CBW program has been altered to permit development of offensive capability in chemical and biological weapons! Exclamation point. The same directives Boyle charges in his book Biowarfare and Terrorism unconstitutionally usurp and nullify the right and the power of the United States Congress to declare war in gross and blatant violation of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the United States Constitution. For fiscal years 2001 through 2004, the federal government funded $14.5 billion for ostensibly civilian biowarfare-related work alone, a truly staggering sum, Boyle wrote. Another $5.6 billion was voted for the deceptively named Project BioShield, under which Homeland Security is stockpiling vaccines and drugs to fight anthrax, smallpox, and other bioterror agents, wrote Boyle. Protection of the civilian population is, he said, one of the fundamental requirements for effectively waging biowarfare. The Washington Post reported December 12th that both houses of Congress this month passed legislation considered by many to be an effort to salvage the two-year-old Project BioShield, which has been marked by delays and operational problems. When President Bush signs it into law, it will allocate $1 billion more over 3 years for additional research to pump more money into the private sector sooner. The enormous amounts of money purportedly dedicated to civilian defense that are now dramatically and increasingly being spent, Boyle writes, betray this administration's effort to be able to embark on offensive campaigns using biowarfare. By pouring huge sums of money into university and private sector laboratories, Boyle charged, federal spending has diverted the U.S. biotech industry to biowarfare. According to Rutgers University, molecular biologist Richard Ebright, over 300 scientific institutions and 12,000 individuals have access to pathogens suitable for biowarfare and terrorism. Ebright found that the number of National Institute of Health grants to research infectious diseases with biowarfare potential has shot up from 33 in 95 to 2000 to 497. Academic biowarfare participation involving the abuse of DNA genetic engineering since the late 80s has become patently obvious, Boyle said. American universities have a long history of willingly permitting their research agendas, researchers, institutes, and laboratories to be co-opted, corrupted, and perverted by the Pentagon and the CIA. These despicable death scientists were arming the Pentagon with the component units necessary to produce a massive array of genetically engineered biological weapons, Boyle said. In a foreword to Boyle's book, Jonathan King, a professor of molecular biology at MIT, wrote that the growing bioterror programs represent a significant emerging danger to our own population and threaten international relations among nations. While such programs are always called defensive, King said, with biological weapons, defensive and offensive programs overlap almost completely. Boyle contends the U.S. is in breach of both the Biological Weapons and Chemical Weapons Conventions and U.S. domestic criminal law. In February 2003, for example, the U.S. granted itself a patent on an illegal long-range biological weapons grenade. Boyle said other countries grasp the military implications of U.S. germ warfare actions and will respond in kind. the world will soon witness a de facto biological arms race among the major biotech states under the guise of defense, and despite the requirements of the Biological Warfare Convention. The massive proliferation of biowarfare technology and facilities, as well as trained scientists and technicians all over the United States, courtesy of the neocon Bush Jr. administration, will render a catastrophic biowarfare or bioterrorist incident or accident at statistical certainty, Boyle warned. As far back as September 2001, according to a report in the New York Times titled, U.S. Pushes Germ Warfare Limits, critics were concerned that the research comes close to violating a global 1972 treaty that banned such weapons. But U.S. officials responded at the time they were more worried about understanding the threat of germ warfare and devising possible defenses. The 1972 treaty, which the U.S. signed, forbids developing weapons that spread disease, such as anthrax, regarded as ideal for germ warfare. According to an article in the Baltimore Chronicle and Sentinel of last September 28th, Milton Leitenberg, a veteran arms control advocate at the University of Maryland, said the government was spending billions on germ warfare with almost no analysis of threat. He said claims terrorists will use weapons have been deliberately exaggerated. In the previous year, 750 U.S. biologists signed a letter protesting what they saw as the excessive study of bioterror threats. The Pentagon has not responded to the charges made by Boyle in this argument. So there's a big, long, scary, important story for you. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. It's December 22nd, 2006. Moving on to our next story, Jeb Bush says, quote, "I have no future." Coming from Reuters, the shadow of President Bush seemed to loom large over his younger brother on Wednesday as the outgoing Florida governor ruled out any plans to return to elected office. "No tengo futuro." I have no future, Jeb Bush told Spanish-language reporters in Miami when asked about any possible political ambitions after he steps down next month. The popular two-term governor has often been touted as a savvy politician with a good chance of following his brother and father, George H.W. Bush, into the White House. But the unpopularity and dismal job approval ratings of his brother may have scuttled any plans Jeb Bush may have had for future politics after running one of America's most crucial swing states for the past 8 years. Bush did not elaborate on his terse no future comment, but he has said repeatedly over the past year that he would not run for president in 2008 and has never seemed comfortable with talk about Bush 3 or the Bush presidential dynasty. Jeb would have made an outstanding presidential candidate, said Kansas Senator Sam Brownback, who joined Bush at a luncheon on Wednesday hosted by a Cuban-American Political Action Committee. Brownback, a Republican who launched an exploratory committee 3 weeks ago to consider his own bid for the presidency, added that he was a Jeb Bush-type conservative. In a backhanded slap at President Bush, Brownback cited, quote, "a heritage issue" as one factor currently weighing against Jeb Bush presidency. "People may be wanting to see a different name," he said. And isn't that the truth? Our next post on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com is the 81st episode of Outside the Box. And Outside the Box is broadcast every Thursday night by Portland Community Media. And it's hosted by Alex Ansari, who also does a show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. That's RBNLive.com. I think his show's on right now, and I think I've said that before in previous episodes. Moving on, another fantastic article from Jerry Mazza. I think this is at least our second or third Jerry Mazza article I've had here on Media Monarchy. Coming from the Online Journal, "No money to treat 9/11 workers, $3 billion a week to fight Iraq." Is this a new 9/11 conspiracy, the New York Times is reporting? That roughly $40 million that was set aside by the federal government to treat rescue workers, volunteers, and firefighters who became ill after helping with a 9/11 cleanup and recovery will run out in months, physicians and federal officials said yesterday, and the fund goes broke while the war meter ticks in Iraq at nearly $3 billion a week. On top of that, that sanctimonious contra-criminal Robert Gates, sworn in Monday as defense secretary, warns us that failure in Iraq would be a calamity that would haunt the United States for years. Well, Bobby, we got a calamity here in New York, still part of the United States, that has haunted us for 5 years and won't go away. So take your commander's assessments, unvarnished and straight from the shoulder, and you know where to put them. Members of Congress from New York and New Jersey had to fight to secure $75 million a year ago to pay for health expenses, which included $40 million for drugs and medical procedures. for some 32,000 workers who reported a variety of illnesses after working at Ground Zero. You remember Ground Zero, don't you? Where some special ops helpers blew up the trade towers? Yes? No? Well, remember this. The two major monitor treatment programs, one run by Mount Sinai Medical Center, the other run by the fire department, said at the present spending rate, treatment money runs out by spring or summer. They told us top federal health officials said that unless more money was forthcoming, they'd have to notify thousands of patients their treatment could end soon. What? And just let them be sick or die? This while you, Mr. Gates, call for a big surge of fresh flesh, blood, and cash to feed the Iraq cannons while these 32,000 heroes languish unto death. Your federal officials tell us if all the workers who needed treatment got it, the bill would be $250 million a year, a bill we're told that may meet with resistance from lawmakers in Washington who are facing intense budget pressures. We've got some intense budget pressures right here, so get real, Mr. Gates. You want to play war? Try the computer game SOCOM 3 U.S. Navy SEALs. It's a killer. You want to be human and smart? Get those U.S. asses back to the masses. Save yourself the trip to Iraq and the taxpayer money. Adjust your war strategy to pay your war bills first for the first responders. Don't wave the flag and make speeches like Bush, then turn your back on the wounded and dying. Use your position, make a decision, do something for them. We've got your co-payment, $256.6 million right here. It includes $163.6 million in direct medical expenses for 19,200 people, $91.2 million for 9,000 patients with respiratory or digestive disorders, $58 million for 8,000 patients with 9/11-related mental illnesses, and $14 million for 1,600 patients with musculoskeletal conditions. Medications account for more than half of the treatment cost. The numbers are from the Times, Secretary Gates. I don't make it up like Dick Cheney made up weapons of mass destruction and their imminent use to get us into Iraq in the first place, or that Saddam sat on Osama's lap and hummed Al-Qaeda in his ear all night. Or, like Miss Rice lied, she didn't want to see a mushroom cloud on the horizon. I have a feeling somebody there is ingesting mushrooms. Let me bring you back to reality, bro, you and your sister Condi. We've got a 49.1 million a year in administrative costs, 6 million for translation services, and an as yet undetermined figure for emerging issues, like complicated orthopedic diseases and disorders that may not become evident for many years, including certain lung and autoimmune diseases and cancers. You know, like Gulf War syndrome, where ex-military good guys and girls and or members of their families or kids drop like flies over the years. I hope you don't think I'm talking apples and oranges here, like it's two different things, 9/11 and Iraq. Uh-huh. It's all about sick and dying Americans and making things better, not worse. Unfortunately, the fire department or Mount Sinai Medical Center are not into drug or gun running or money laundering like you and the boys were into in Nicaragua and with the Iranians, so we have to rely on our real government, not the shadow government, to pay up. We need to give that honest advice to President Bush. And don't let him stonewall you with, we simply cannot afford to fail in the Middle East because the U.S. is failing miserably in New York, never mind the Middle East. And that is haunting our nation right now, like now, this minute, and tomorrow. Even Miss Clinton, the ex-First Lady, even Miss Clinton thinks what the federal government has done for Ground Zero firefighters has been too little, too late. And she said, I'm not going to say where the money should come from, I'm merely saying that this should be a national priority. It's not just a New York priority. She's right. And if the president is short on cash, maybe he could call a buddy at the Fed and have them pack the $250 million and ship it to his favorite bank like they usually do when things get tight. I suggest that because Dr. John O. Agwuboni, Assistant Secretary for Health at the Department of Health and Human Services, and Dr. John Howard, the Director of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which prepared the estimate, are co-chairmen of a task force to examine 9/11 health issues, and they made no promises, no commitments about the funds coming to New York. Holly Babin, a spokeswoman for the Department of Health and Human Services, wasn't even familiar with the estimate. Duh. But she said they were looking at several approaches, options, and models. I say cash is best, real money, like the kind used to buy weapons, or pay for contractors in Iraq, or for soldiers' lives and limbs. That's what we need here in a little old war-torn New York 5 years after the dastardly deed. Remember, Bob? Cash. $250 million. What's more, the health folks have to move their bureaucratic butts because this $250 million has to get into the president's budget. We can't sit on it while engaging in studies. Study this. There's people are sick and some people are going to die. Get one of these wart heads to put the item in the budget and get a plan to get it sold, because we have felt the stakes in the war on terror. They were driven like the Twin Towers right through our hearts. But that's war, Mr. Secretary. That's war. The question is, how sick are you and all the rest of the neocons that you want more and more of it? Remember Vietnam? 58,000 dead, and we went home with our tails between our legs because it was a no-win war from the Gulf of Tonkin non-incident. So don't let this war, contrived from the start, suck us into the moral and financial bankruptcy. Speaking of that, our big city mayors and friends have been paying medical disability benefits with retirement money, and now there's a whole new hole that's growing. In fact, all over America, you would find cities with holes in them, in their budgets, their schools, their roads, their social services, their families who are going broke from exported jobs, old wars, the new war, and all hell turned loose on them. So be a hero. Tell the president to change his plan. Put America's pieces back together again. Heal the sick and dying from 9/11. Bring the soldiers home and stop making that dumb speech, "Failure in Iraq will haunt the U.S." You and yours have been haunting us for 40 years. Enough is enough. And that's another great article from Jerry Mazza, posted on the online journal. My name's James, and you're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. You can go to praradio.com for the stream, mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for all the news and clips and videos and links and stories that you hear right here. Our next story is coming to us from the great site Blacklisted News. I check it every day, repeatedly. Oh, yeah, this is a fun one. Baby sent through X-ray machine at LAX. Though explained away as an accident, the guilty until proven innocent, 100% suspicion at all times, authoritarian, absurdist environment that has been created in airports most likely led this Spanish woman simply to assume that she had to X-ray her baby in the interests of security. So now the story from the LA Times. A woman going through security at Los Angeles International Airport put her month-old grandson into a plastic bin intended for carry-on items and slid it into an X-ray machine. The early Saturday accident, bizarre but not unprecedented, caught airport workers by surprise, even though the security line was not busy at the time, officials said. A screener watching the machine's monitor immediately noticed the outline of a baby and pulled the bin backward on the conveyor belt. The infant was taken to Sentinella Hospital, where doctors determined that he had not received a dangerous dose of radiation.
A woman put her one-month-old grandson through the X-ray machine at LAX, and now officials are trying to understand exactly why she did that. Let's go to Bill Smith, who is live at LAX with the very latest. Bill?
Yes, Cher, that's right. These things are familiar to all of us. Anybody who flies, you know, you have to put your coat in there and your shoes in there, and then this goes through the X-ray and you get it on the other end. It's intended for stuff like that. It is not intended for babies, and it brings up the obvious point, do not put the baby in the bin. Don't do it. Although this grandmother did. She put the baby in the bin. Fortunately, a TSA screener saw the baby on the screen as it went through and immediately yanked the baby out. Now, the baby was taken to a hospital. The baby was okay, and they went on to their flight down to Mexico City on Alaska Airlines after that. Back in 1998, it's about the last time, somebody sent a baby in a car seat through the X-ray. That baby was okay. Now, LAX says a billion years since then, and here we go again. A baby going through the X-ray, this time in the bin. Baby going through the bin. Again, stressing right away that the baby is okay, and they want to be sure you don't do that. In fact, the TSA is quite concerned about how that people understand exactly what you need to do. And if you go to their website, which is tsa.gov, you'll get some suggestions about traveling with children, how to take your kids through. And again, kids may not always understand. I know, kids are pretty savvy these days. But for the younger kids who don't know how to do that, you kind of got to coach them through the screening process and what the X-ray is all about. Again, this is on tsa.gov. It's a pretty thorough wrap-up of exactly what you need to do, although it never considered babies in the bin. So we'll consider you off of that one right now. It does say never leave babies in an infant carrier when it goes through the X-ray. That was an infant carrier as opposed to just putting the baby in the bin. Never, never, never. Passengers this morning say it is pretty much unbelievable. And here it says Daddy's Girl on her, by the way. She's lined up here. You're going to Maui today?
Yes, we are.
All right. Now, you've seen these before. These are the things you put your shoes in so it goes through security.
Right.
You can put shoes. You can put a coat in there. Would you put a baby in there?
No.
No. Somebody did put a baby in there. What do you think?
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
Yeah, a baby. The baby's okay, but imagine putting the baby in this and going right through the security.
I'd have to see it to believe it.
Yeah, it actually happened. Thank you very much. In fact, let me ask this young man back here, too. Good morning.
Hi,
where are you headed off to today?
Miami.
Miami.
Miami, okay. It's warmer in Miami than it is here. This is what goes through the security. You put your shoes, you put your jacket in there. Somebody put a baby in there. The baby went right through. Yes.
Wow. I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it was, you know, I guess some people are just not familiar with how all of this works. The baby's okay, but the baby went right through.
Oh, wow. That don't make any sense.
No, it's all about just being a little bit confused. How much radiation is all of this about? Well, to categorize it in millirems, which is one of those scientific measurements of small amounts of radiation, just going through the airport luggage screener, you only get 1 millirem of radiation. If you fly cross-country on an airliner, when you're up high above the ozone, you know, where you're up where the atmosphere is thinner, you can actually get about 5 millirems. A chest x-ray is 10 millirems, and a mammogram is 30. So those levels are pretty high compared to the baby going through the screener and only getting 1 millirem. By the way, an LAPD officer came by a short time ago, didn't want to go on television, but said he was out here when that happened. He was part of it, and he says the baby was just fine. Kind of looked around and said, whoa, how about this? Maybe the baby was saying, let's do it again. Don't do it again. Live from LAX, Bill Smith, back to Hollywood.
All right, Bill, at least the baby's okay. Thank you so much.
Bill Smith, a babbling idiot from KTLA, who seemed really fixated on saying, baby in the bin, baby in the bin. You know those news folks. They like to find that key phrase and repeat it over and over again. Like I've been repeating over and over again, you're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. It's December 22nd, 2006. This is our seventh episode. Next story on Media Monarchy is another great one from Truth Dig. Bush can't kick the habit. Here we go again. A new Secretary of Defense and yet another call for ending the war in Iraq by escalating it. What are they smoking in the Bush White House? Even as government statistics now show marijuana is America's number one cash crop, it's important to remember that militarism is the most dangerous drug threatening our sanity. Yet even formerly sober folks, first Colin Powell and now new Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, get a contact high from cozying up to the walking hallucinogen that is our president. Succumbing to the Bush fantasy that freedom is fertilized by firepower, a vision that has mucked up Iraq beyond recognition, Gates told CBS that, quote, as the president has made clear, we simply cannot afford to fail in the Middle East. I think we heard that one. Failure in Iraq at this juncture would be a calamity that would haunt our nation, impair our credibility, and endanger Americans for generations to come. This from a man who recently made sense during his confirmation hearings when he told members of Congress that we are not winning this war, despite having committed proportionally as many troops as we did in Vietnam. But now, as a rising chorus of obsessed hawks call for a surge in U.S. troop deployment in Iraq, a call echoed even by some prominent Democrats, Gates endorses the staying the course strategy for compounding the Iraq failure rejected by the voters. A member of the bipartisan Iraq study group, who had apparently supported its unanimous findings that the military strategy was bankrupt, is suddenly blinded by the Bush's Iraq victory myopia. In a sign of just how out there Bush is on Iraq, the Washington Post reported Tuesday that the military's Joint Chiefs of Staff are in unanimous disagreement with White House officials aggressively promoting the concept. The Joint Chiefs think the White House, after a month of talks, still does not have a defined mission in Iraq. All this despite the fact that the Iraq Study Group report correctly underscored that the real failures in the Middle East have clearly been political, not military. The accurate subtext of the reports is that the continued U.S. military presence in Iraq is the key source of chaos in the region, inflaming religious fanaticism from Beirut to Baghdad and leaving the United States dependent on the tyrants in Iran, Syria, and Saudi Arabia to now bail us out. So with Bush rejecting the sage advice of a commission heeded by his father's Secretary of State to cut our losses, is there any hope the Democrats who now control Congress will stop playing the role of enabler to these war junkies? After all, it was the Democratic congressional leadership that provided Bush with bipartisan cover for his irrational anti-terrorism invasions of a country that had nothing to do with 9/11. Some, like John Kerry, now recognize that folly, and even Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton, in her appearance on NBC's Today show, finally expressed her regrets for supporting the war and opposed a surge in U.S. troops for Iraq. Speaking of too little, too late, but other Democrats continue to play the dangerous game of supporting Bush's escalation. Particularly alarming were the remarks on Sunday of incoming Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid endorsing a buildup as long as it aims at getting the troops home by 2008. If the commanders on the ground said this is just for a short period of time, we'll go along with that, Reid said. The convenient lie behind all of this is that U.S. military occupation is the indispensable agent of Mideast enlightenment. No, we have become the enablers of Iraqi madness, be it in the form of torture or the ascendancy of religious tyranny in Iraq, where daily life has been reduced to an unmitigated horror. Yet, like a junkie who needs one more hit to get his life in order, Bush is hooked on the drug of military might. If the Democrats continue to feed his dangerous habit, they will only help Bush visit greater mayhem upon Iraq while undermining the core values of our own country. Our next story is coming from the Financial Times, and it's kind of a shift from where we've been over the last hour. UK report says robots will have rights. The next time you beat your keyboard in frustration, think of a day where it may be able to sue you for assault. Within 50 years, we might even find ourselves standing next to the next generation of vacuum cleaners in the voting booth. Far from being extracts from an extreme end of science fiction, the idea that we may one day give sentient machines the kind of rights traditionally reserved for humans is raised in a British government-commissioned report which claims to be an extensive look into the future. Visions of the status of robots around 2056 have emerged from one of 270 forward-looking papers sponsored by Sir David King, the UK government's chief scientist. The paper covering robots' rights was written by a UK partnership of Outsights, the management consultancy, and Ipsos Mori, the opinion research organization. If we make conscious robots, they would want to have rights, and they probably should, says Heinrich Christensen, director of the Center of Robotics and Intelligent Machines at the Georgia Institute of Technology. The idea will not surprise science fiction aficionados. It was widely explored by Dr. Isaac Asimov, one of the foremost science fiction writers of the 20th century. He wrote of a society where robots were fully integrated and essential in day-to-day life. In his system, the three laws of robotics governed machine life. They decreed that robots could not injure humans, must obey orders, and protect their own existence, in that order. Robots and machines are now classed as inanimate objects without rights or duties, but if artificial intelligence becomes ubiquitous, the report argues, there may be calls for human rights to be extended to them. It is also logical that such rights are meted out with citizens' duties, including voting, paying tax, and compulsory military service. Mr. Christensen said, would it be acceptable to kick a robotic dog even though we shouldn't kick a normal one? There will be people who can't distinguish that, so we need to have ethical rules to make sure we as humans interact with robots in an ethical manner so we do not move our boundaries of what is acceptable. The Horizon Scan report argues that if correctly managed, this new world of robots' rights could lead to increased labor output and greater prosperity. If granted full rights, states will be obligated to provide full social benefits to them, including income support, housing, and possibly robo-healthcare to fix the machines over time, it says. But it points out that the process has casualties, and the first one may be the environment, especially in the areas of energy and waste. I'm sorry, that cracks me up every time I read robots' rights. So that story's on Financial Times, and you can get it on Media Monarchy. Our next story, biggest price jump in 30 years. This is coming from the AFP. U.S. inflation made a surprise comeback in November with a surprising 2% rise in wholesale prices, the biggest monthly jump in 30 years, the government has reported. The surprise jump in prices challenges expectations from economists and the Federal Reserve that inflation is under control. Some analysts say the Fed is in a bind because inflation remains troublesome despite soft economic growth. Thing to take away from that is the dollar is crumbling, and we'll get to another story about that in just a little bit. Coming up next from Reuters and AlertNet, U.S. to warn Iran with naval buildup in Gulf, and we've gone over that here before on Media Monarchy. The Pentagon is planning a major buildup of U.S. naval forces in and around the Gulf as a warning to Iran, CBS News reported on Monday. A senior Defense Department official told Reuters the report was premature and appeared to be drawing conclusions from assumptions. The official did not know of plans for major changes in naval deployment. Another Defense Department official called the report speculative, and a Pentagon spokeswoman declined to comment. Citing unidentified military officers, CBS said the plan called for the deployment of a second U.S. aircraft carrier to join the one already in the region. The network said the buildup, which would begin in January, was not aimed at an attack on Iran, but to discourage what U.S. officials view as increasingly provocative acts by Tehran. The report said Iranian naval exercises in the Gulf, its support for Shiite militias in Iraq, and Iran's nuclear program were causes for concern among U.S. officials. Now, if you look at who helped build the largest nuclear reactor in Tehran, the receipts lead back to us. Speaking of nuclear, our next story coming from the UPI, the Mooney Press, if you like. Mishap in dismantling nuclear warhead. A watchdog group charges a nuclear warhead nearly exploded in Texas when it was being dismantled at the government's Pantex facility near Amarillo. The Project on Government Oversight says it has been told by knowledgeable experts that the warhead nearly detonated in 2005 because an unsafe amount of pressure was applied while it was being dismantled, the Austin American-Statesman reports. The U.S. Energy Department fined the plant's operators $110,000 last month. An investigator for Project on Government Oversight says the weapon involved was a W-56 warhead with 100 times the destructive power of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. 100 times the destructive power of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The watchdog group says the problem was caused in part by technicians at the plant being required to work up to 72 hours a week. They released an anonymous letter reportedly sent by Pantex employees warning that long hours and efforts to increase output were causing dangerous conditions at the plant. A spokesperson for the Energy Department declined to respond to safety complaints in the letter. That seems like a running theme for the episode. Declining to comment. Oh, this is what I was mentioning. Again, from the AFP, Iran dumps dollar for euro. The Iranian government said it has ordered the central bank to transform the state's dollar-dominated assets held abroad into euros and use the European currency for foreign transactions. The government has ordered the central bank to replace the dollar with the euro to limit the problems of the executive organs in commercial transactions, government spokesman said. We will also employ this change for Iranian assets in dollars held abroad. The move comes amid mounting pressure from the United States for UN Security Council to agree to sanctions against Iran over its controversial nuclear program. The government spokesman, Elham, added that Iran's budget would in future be calculated according to euros. Until now, the budget has been calculated according to revenues in dollars, but this calculation will now change. Now, will this cause the run on the dollar, and will all the foreign investors all start to dump it? And then will you run to your bank to get your money out, only to find that everyone else has run to the bank to get their money out, and then there won't be any money to get out? So we'll see. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. Cramming through all the news and disturbing things going on in the world. MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com is the place to go for all these news and videos and sounds and links. All the news that you hear, I have links throughout all these stories to pertinent documents and other things. You can basically go down the rabbit hole of the hyperlink. The next story, U.S. military rehearses terror hearings, and this is coming from the AP. The U.S. military is rehearsing for hearings on whether 14 top terror suspects can be held indefinitely without charges as enemy combatants, but defense lawyers say the outcome is preordained. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM, alleged mastermind of 9/11, and the 13 others will be the highest-profile detainees to undergo the so-called combatant status review tribunals, and the first to do so in 2 years. The proceedings expected early next year are open to the media. At the hearings, a military panel will evaluate whether the men should be classified as enemy combatants, a designation which allows them to be held indefinitely and prevents them from challenging their detention in the U.S. court system. The biggest thing we're doing is opening up the books, reviewing procedures, and conducting rehearsals so that we do it correctly, Navy Captain Philip Waddingham told reporters who recently visited Guantanamo. He is the lead officer at Guantanamo for the Pentagon Base Office in charge of determining detainee status. It is unclear whether Mohammed and the others, who until recently were being held in secret CIA prisons, will agree to attend the hearings. If they do, the military says they will remain shackled and would be forbidden to talk to reporters. I wonder if they'll also be fitted with a shock belt like Zacharias Moussaoui was. So, speaking of CIA secret prisons, we're going to listen to a CBC Passionate Eye report posted to Google Video by yours truly, Media Monarchy. And you can watch that video on Google Video, or you can find it on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. It's the CIA's Secret War, and you're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority.
Tonight on The Passionate Eye, is the CIA engaged in a secret war in Europe involving abduction, imprisonment, and even torture?
Masked men took me into an interrogation room where other masked men were waiting for me.
Step behind the scenes of a special inquiry into illegal CIA activities that are part of the U.S. war on terror.
We've uncovered numerous lies concerning the relations between the European government and the CIA.
The CIA's secret war.
September 11, 2001. The United States declares war on terror. Some of the battlefields are well known. Taliban-run Afghanistan, Saddam Hussein's Iraq. But far from the bombs, another conflict starts to brew. An invisible war led by the United States right here in Europe. Evidence unearthed as early as 2005 shows the CIA was running an illegal operation on our soil, abducting European citizens, transferring them on private CIA planes, arbitrarily detaining suspects in secret prisons, and even torturing. We decided to take a closer look at this secret war inside Europe. On this day, the European Parliament holds a historic vote. For the first time ever, it opens an inquiry into the CIA's secret activities in Europe. The inquiry group is comprised of 46 members of European Parliament, or MEPs, from 15 different countries. It is headed by committee chairman Carlos Coelho, the centrist 46-year-old former Portuguese Secretary of State. Baroness Sarah Lutford, a 55-year-old British Liberal MEP. Claudio Fava, a socialist Italian MEP from Sicily, the son of a reporter killed 20 years ago for investigating the mafia.
We know there have been a lot of abuses the last few years in the war on terror. Our committee's goal is to look into these abuses and determine if European Union countries are partly responsible for them. Who decided to turn a blind eye? Who refused to see it? Who decided to actively work with the CIA in abusing the law?
The MEPs let us follow their investigations for 6 months. We worked at the heart of this extraordinary inquiry from March to July 2006, capturing each new development. It starts up in July 2006. The first key witness to appear before the committee is Khaled El-Masri, a German citizen of Lebanese descent. He was abducted in Europe and illegally held in Afghanistan for 5 months, and he's convinced the CIA was behind it. His attorney tells the MEPs how El-Masri's saga started. He was arbitrarily arrested at the Macedonian border in ex-Yugoslavia.
They took him to the Skopje airport, where they gave him a medical exam in a side room. They blindfolded him and tied him up. He didn't know what was going on. All of a sudden, several people started beating and kicking him. The blows were raining from all directions. It's the first time a victim has spoken out before an institution like the European Parliament.
The American press broke the news of El-Masri's ordeal 3 months earlier. Today, he's still too shaken up to talk to reporters.
Living in the story is a cruel story. For him, it's too much. And I want to avoid that he breaks down, and he broke down already in some interviews.
So we went to visit him at his home in Ulm in southern Germany. The 38-year-old father of four is a political refugee. Before his misadventure, Khaled El-Masri was a used car salesman. Today he's unemployed.
I'm originally from Lebanon. I came to Germany in 1985 and became a German citizen in 1994.
His nightmare begins in December 2003. He goes on holiday, crossing Europe by bus. Austria, Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia. By December 31st, he arrives in Macedonia, and his troubles begin. During a routine customs check, he is arrested and questioned, then immediately transferred to a hotel in the capital, Skopje.
Armed Macedonians, in plain clothes, interrogated me for a long, long time. They kept me hidden away. I was kept laying down in a bed. When I went to the bathroom, the door had to stay open. They never let me out of their sight. During the 23 days they held me, I only took one shower. And during that one shower, somebody was watching me.
One thing struck him during his detention.
There was a computer in the room. After about a week, I don't remember exactly how long, they decided to turn it on, and they started watching porn films and other things I couldn't see.
After being held for 3 weeks, his ordeal took a new turn. Khalid El-Masri says that masked men dressed in black took him away. He was thrown into a commercial plane, blindfolded, and tied to his seat. After a 12-hour flight and a stopover in Baghdad, he landed in Kabul, Afghanistan.
The first night I was held there, masked men took me into an interrogation room where other masked men were waiting for me. There was an Arab translator and an American doctor who never said a word. I was told they were American. That first night, they made me understand very clearly, you're in a lawless country. We can bury you or forget you somewhere for 20 years. Nobody will ever know what happened to you. I don't know how I survived, even today, because that prison was truly inhumane.
El-Masri sleeps on the bare ground through his entire detention, eating only leftovers. After 5 months, the Americans realize they've nabbed the wrong man. Khalid El-Masri is flown to an undisclosed location in Europe.
When they released me in the middle of the forest, at night, I didn't know where to go. They just pointed towards a path. It was a really bleak place. I thought they were going to shoot me. 400 meters later, I came on three armed men in uniforms. They checked my identity papers and took me into a hut with an Albanian flag flying over the door.
El-Masri finally makes his way back to Germany. This is the first photo taken after his return. He tells his story to an attorney who 8 months later exposes the story of his detention to the U.S. press. The Bush administration says El-Masri is making it all up. Germany takes a cautious stance, saying authorities were never informed of his disappearance. Charges are pressed. The Court of Munich will hear his case. But our MEPs decide to check out his story. 1 month after El-Masri testifies in Brussels, they fly to Macedonia. There, too, national authorities have steadfastly denied El-Masri's version of the events. Italian MEP Fava compares the diverging stories and can't help but feel that something isn't right.
I'm in the process of reading all the official statements and depositions from the German and Macedonian governments and comparing them with what El-Masri told the committee. One thing is sure. His version differs radically from theirs. It's clear that someone isn't telling the truth. Our trip to Macedonia is going to help us determine who's telling the truth and who's lying.
Macedonia, a tiny former Yugoslav republic now vying to join the European Union. 1 hour after touchdown, the five MEPs investigating for Brussels have an appointment with the President of the Republic himself.
As President of the Republic, I want to assure you that all of the institutions involved in this matter are at your full disposal to help you get to the truth.
I hope our meeting will be a good starting point for your visit and work here in Macedonia.
After the polite exchange of greetings, we are asked to leave the room. Behind this door, the president reiterates the official version. After being questioned at the border, Khaled El-Masri was authorized to enter Macedonia, where he spent 23 days on vacation. When they come back out, our MEPs are skeptical.
It's a lack of 23 days. It's impossible that this man disappeared.
The next morning, they meet with Interior Minister Majlovski, the man in charge of the El-Masri case.
Mr. Bomeva from Spain.
Hello.
And Mr. Czernetsky from Poland.
We're not allowed to sit in on the meeting, but we did manage to get a copy of what was said. The MEP said,
I'm sorry, but for us it is clear that El-Masri was detained here, and that there was a CIA flight leaving Skopje for Kabul via Baghdad on the 24th of January, 2004.
The minister's reply.
We have the number of the plane leaving Skopje, but we don't have data that this plane is of the CIA.
Reporter's question.
The sky over Baghdad was closed during this period of war. How do you explain that this plane was authorized to fly from Skopje to Baghdad?
The minister's reply.
We don't check private planes. If you know what is behind all of this, please let me know.
Afterwards, the minister's account of the meeting with the press is much more diplomatic.
Today we met with the European Committee of Inquiry. We had a very constructive exchange, and I hope that what we told them will help throw light on this matter. I think this should put an end to rumors that Macedonian secret police were involved in this affair.
When the minister finishes, we have one last question for him.
When we were talking, Skopje Merak, he was free.
Yes, in Skopje Merak, he was free. He was there for
the bill?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
So I think so, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Because they will not let you out of the hotel if you don't pay the bill. it's a normal. No.
The MEPs only got one piece of information out of him, but it's an important one. The name of the hotel where El-Masri spent his so-called vacation.
It's the first time he said that El-Masri spent 23 days in a hotel. In this hotel.
This is the hotel, located in a residential area of the capital, 300 meters from the U.S. Embassy. Before their visit, our MEP investigators contacted the hotel manager and set up a meeting with him.
Yeah, but does somebody know that we wanted to meet the director?
Could you turn the camera off?
But there's a problem. The manager has disappeared. Apparently left on vacation. 1 hour later, the receptionist finally agrees to show them the room. Room number 11, on the fourth floor. This is where El-Masri was supposedly held. First observation, everything matches up. The room is exactly the way El-Masri described it. Even the computer sitting on the desk.
It's hard to imagine that an unemployed person who travels from Germany by bus with hardly any money on him could spend 23 days in this room during the Christmas holiday season. We're not getting all the truth here. Who brought him here? Who held him here?
Do you want to have a look at the other rooms?
No. They are all the same.
But maybe...
No, the only thing is possible to see the guest book.
Yeah. Okay. So, we go down...
Okay.
but they will never see the guestbook. The MEPs aren't authorized to seize documents, only to question witnesses. When they're not away on vacation, that is.
It's normal that we didn't find anything. The hotel manager knew we were coming, so he took a few days off. We already knew everything they told us. I'd have to be pretty stupid to think they were waiting around to tell us, "Oh, good God, you've uncovered the scandal. Of course you're in a CIA hotel here." No, that's not what I expected.
The shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. And AEC has figures, but it keeps them out of sight. When the shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows start to spread. Strontium 90 shows no color, but it leaves you just as dead. Strontium 90 leaves no clue, dear. It's not like thalidomide. If the baby is deformed, dear, you just blame the other side. Strontium 90 leaves no trace, dear. No one knows who gets the knife. You can always say that background radiation took the life in your milk on Monday morning. Comes an extra little kick. Well, the taste is just the same, dear. But the Geiger counters click. Oh, the shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. And the AEC has figures, but they keep them out of sight.
That was Pete Seeger with Mac the Bomb. And you're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. It's December 22nd. It's our seventh episode. And you can get podcasts of the previous six episodes by going to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. And they are hosted by the good folks at radioforall.net. Our next story on Media Monarchy, e-passports at risk from cloning. This is coming from the Big Brother Corporation, the BBC. The e-passport is one of the many measures pursued by the United States and governments internationally after the horror of 9/11. It will, we are promised, keep the unwanted and dangerous outside our borders while streamlining entry for those welcome to come and visit. But as the implementation of the scheme gets underway, it is becoming clear that there could be serious problems with it. With the old passport, we knew where we stood. If you lost it, you knew you had lost it. But with the new, machine-readable passports, the story is very different. When you take a digital photo, the image is, in effect, a code, which means that however many prints you make, they are all exactly the same. Reading on from the BBC report, e-passports at risk from cloning. So when Lucas Grunewald and Christian Böttger realized they could clone the new e-passport, they were pretty sure it would be identical to the original and undetectable. So how did they do it? The chip inside the e-passport is a radio frequency identification, RFID chip, of the type poised to replace the barcode in supermarkets. The good thing about RFID chips is that they emit radio signals that can be read at a short distance by an electronic reader. But this is also the bad thing about them because, as Lucas demonstrated to me, he can easily download the data from his passport using an RFID reader he got for 200 euros on eBay. Lucas is less forthcoming about where he got what is called the Golden Reader Tool. It is the software used by border police, and it allows him to read the chip on his e-passport, including the photo. Now for the clever bit. Thanks to software he himself has developed, called RF Dump, he downloads the passport's data onto his computer and then onto a blank chip. Using a standard off-the-shelf component you can just buy at a component store, you can have a cloned e-passport in less than 5 minutes. When the cloned e-passport is read and compared to the original one, it behaves exactly the same. The UK Home Office, however, dismissed the ability to get a hold of the information on the chip. A spokesman said, "It is hard to see why anyone would want access to the information on the chip. Other than the photograph, which could be obtained easily by other means, they would gain no information than they did not already have. So the whole exercise would be pointless. The only information stored on the e-passport chip is the basic information you can see on the personal details page." The spokesman said the chip was one part of the security features of the e-passport. He said, "Being able to copy this does not mean that the passport can be forged or imitated for illegal or unauthorized use. British e-passports are designed in such a way as to make the chip substitution virtually impossible, and the security features of the passport render the forgery of the complete document impractical." According to Lucas Grunewald of the consulting company DN Systems, an e-passport holder is more at risk from someone trying to steal their data. "Nearly every country issuing this passport has a few security experts who are yelling at the top of their lungs and trying to shout out, 'This is not secure. This is not a good idea to use this technology.'" DN Systems' Christian Botker also believes the system was set up in a hurry. "It's much too complicated. It is in places done the wrong way around, reading data first, parsing data, interpreting data, then verifying whether it's right. There are lots of technical flaws in it, and there are things that have not just been forgotten, so it is basically not doing what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to get a higher security level. It is not," he said. And I've had numerous previous stories on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com about the imminent hackability of our coming e-passports and national ID cards. There's a quick little bit I posted that was on MSNBC. It was a poll about Donald Rumsfeld's legacy. And was he a military leader to be admired? 19% said yes. Is he a failed military strategist? 81% said yes. Our next story, coming from Raw Story. "Don't worry, it's not as bad as it looks," President Bush reportedly, told a friend depressed by the ongoing unpopular war and GOP woes, according to an article in Sunday's Washington Post. "For a man who presides over an unpopular war, just lost Congress, and faces a final 2 years with a constrained option, Bush gives little sign of self-pity," Peter Baker writes. The analysis, entitled "Stubborn or Stalwart, Bush is Loath to Budge," examines the following question: at what point does determination to a cause become self-defeating folly? Can he change direction in a meaningful way without sacrificing principle? Our next story, coming from almost a week ago, last Saturday. Riot cops detain hundreds of activists in Moscow, and this is coming from the Edmonton Sun. Russian authorities pulled hundreds of opposition activists off buses and trains and detained them along with scores of others on Saturday ahead of a rare anti-government rally in Moscow, organizers said. The police action did not prevent more than 2,000 people from gathering in a central square where leftist and liberal groups demanded that Russian President Vladimir Putin stop what they called Russia's retreat from democracy. "In 15 months, political power will be changed," said Mikhail Kalyanov, a former prime minister who is now an opposition leader, referring to the March 2008 presidential election. "Next year, everyone should make a personal decision about what to do with our country, whether we will allow these people to continue their illegal undertakings or we finally make our main goal to build a democratic and socially oriented state," Kazayanov told demonstrators. Garry Kasparov, the former chess grandmaster who has emerged as one of the Kremlin's most prominent critics, said the mere fact that the rally took place made it a success, given the efforts by authorities to stop it. "We are protesting, and it means that authorities are not as monolithic and powerful as they believe," he said. "They are afraid that one day we will tell them enough." The demonstrators chanted freedom and held banners reading "No to Police State" and Russia without Putin. Our next story coming from ABC News. Ex-Representative Bob Barr quits the GOP for the Libertarian Party. And it was funny because I posted the story and then went to see Borat just the other day. And Bob Barr is featured in Borat, eating cheese that he is told by Borat comes from his wife's tit. This is coming from ABC News. A former Georgia congressman who helped spark President Clinton's impeachment has quit the Republican Party to become a libertarian, saying he is disillusioned with the GOP on issues such as spending and privacy. Bob Barr, who served 8 years as a Republican congressman before losing his seat in 2002, announced Friday that he is now a, quote, proud card-carrying libertarian, and he encouraged others to join him. Something that's been bothering me for quite some time, the direction in which the party's been going more and more toward big government and disregard toward privacy and civil liberty, said Barr, 58, a lawyer and consultant living in Atlanta. In terms of where the country needs to be going to get back to our constitutional roots, I've come to the conclusion that the only way to do that is to work with a party that practices what it preaches, and that is the Libertarian Party. Barr said he has no plans to run for office. In his new role as the Libertarian Party's regional representative for the South, he will help promote the party's message and recruit candidates, he said. Barr helped manage the House Republicans' impeachment case before the Senate in 1999. And finally, with our new news postings on Media Monarchy, the White House objects to talks. This is coming from the Times Online UK. The White House has made clear its outright opposition to the idea of direct talks with Syria and Iran on the issue of Iraq, after sharply criticizing a group of Democrat senators for meeting the leadership in Damascus. Responding to a trip to Syria this week by Ben Nelson, a Florida Democrat, in a meeting this weekend between Senator John Kerry and President Assad of Syria and Damascus, Tony Snow, President Bush's spokesman, said that the moves were not helpful and not appropriate. Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, also rejected the idea of seeking Syria and Iran's help in Iraq, which was a recommendation of the bipartisan Iraq study group. And with that, I'm going to move to a little film strip going all the way back to 1945. This is from the good folks at archive.org and made by Encyclopedia Britannica Films. Let's learn about democracy.
Democracy has been defined in many ways. We would all agree that democracy includes government. Let's see if we can, each one of us, sharpen of democracy. We know that democratic words and forms have been written into laws. But it is the way people practice democracy that really counts. Let's ask this man about defining democracy. He studies communities and the way people live in them. He goes about his job scientifically, observing, recording, analyzing, and reporting.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Students of society have been reporting their observations and analyses for a good many centuries. And as yet, there is not one single definition of democracy that they would all accept. There's one point, however, they would all agree on, and this is it. In thinking seriously of democracy, one must define his words carefully and use them consistently. When you have your own definitions clear, you know exactly what to look for in a community.
Many students agree that two important signs of democracy are shared respect and a shared power. Let's take shared respect first. Sharing respect means that each shares the respect of all, not because of his wealth, or his religion, or his color, but because each is a human being and makes his own contribution to the community, from healing its sick to collecting its garbage, from managing its railroads to running its trains. One sign of shared respect in a community is that everybody is given a fair chance to develop useful skills and the chance to put these skills to effective use. And there is shared respect if various groups in the community recognize each other's right to hold different faiths and opinions. And now let's see how we spot the second of the two signs of democracy, shared power. Most observers agree that there is true democracy in a community only if there is shared power. That is to say, only if many people have a share in making decisions that the community will support with force if necessary. More specifically, you can say that power is shared wherever regular popular elections are authorized and are actually held. There is shared power wherever people actually get out voluntarily and vote. And if they can vote without interference or pressure from anybody. There is shared power if office holders are drawn from representative groups in society. If they include men from the farms, men from the law courts, men from the stores, men from the factories, office holders who are drawn from representative groups of the community. In a democratic legislature, shared power shows itself in a strong opposition. Listen.
And that is why I'm confident the governor will have the support of the House on this bill. Mr. Speaker, as usual, the honorable gentleman is quite wrong. He and the governor he serves so dutifully can expect no support for their policy from this House.
A strong opposition is made possible by an effective political party system. The two most important signs of democracy, then, are shared respect and shared power. They, in turn, depend on many conditions. Let's consider two of these conditions, economic balance and enlightenment. Economic balance means that the community contains a large middle-income group.
A relationship between economic balance and democracy has been noted and reported for centuries by students of society. Aristotle said that a government made up of middle-income people has the best chance to be democratic. That was 2,000 years ago in Greece. And well over a century ago in America, James Madison warned that extremes of riches and poverty set group against group.
In past centuries, economic balance was improved when large feudal estates were gradually reorganized into independent farms, as one part of the development of democracy. This creation of better economic balance aided the further growth of democracy. The social observers of our time have also noted that the development of democracy usually goes hand in hand with the growth of large middle-income groups. In today's world of giant technology, one of democracy's serious problems is how to maintain flourishing middle-income groups. Another important condition for democracy is enlightenment. Making information available to citizens and giving them the skill with which to judge it. As public education increases, democracy grows. In checking a community for democracy, we must find out whether it provides schools adjusted to the needs of its young people. Just being able to get books and newspapers is no guarantee of democracy. The newspapers of a real democracy meet these tests. Balanced presentation of news. Disclosure of source. Competence of the staff. In applying these tests to newspapers, we find out, first of all, if they report both. See if the news pages contain news only, and if opinion is kept for the editorial page. Next, we see if the paper says plainly who publishes and edits it. We know which side they're on. Newspapers in a real democracy meet a third test, competence of staff. This test requires newspaper men to value accuracy and impartiality, and to interpret the news skillfully for the public. The competence test also requires newspaper men to use the services of experts.
I want 500 words on freedom of the press for our anniversary edition. How about it?
But, Professor, you know more about the history of freedom of the press than probably any other man in the country.
Yes, that's right. I mean the responsibility of a free press and other forms of communication like the radio and the movies to enlighten the people into democracy.
When we examine any democratic community, large or small, or just average, we find that we can separate out two distinct signs of democracy: shared respect and shared power. They, in turn, depend on at least two conditions in the community: economic balance and enlightenment. There is no standing still. The more economic balance and enlightenment, the more shared respect and shared power. Democracy is something that's never finished. It wanes with neglect, and it grows with care. If a community works to balance its economy, and if it works to enlighten its citizens, such a community can achieve shared respect. And it can achieve shared power. By working hard at it, the citizens of any community can achieve democracy.
Your fears.
That was Cursive with Flag and Family off the latest record, Happy Hollow, and we heard, I guess, the appropriately named TV on the Radio for that with Bomb Yourself. And yes, we started it with an Encyclopedia Britannica film from 1945 learning about democracy. And you can go to Google Video for that. And it's also posted on mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. And that's the name of the show you've been listening to for the last 2 hours. My name's James. That's pretty much going to do it for this December 22nd, 2006 episode. It's our seventh episode. I want to remind you that I've got podcasts of previous six episodes up. Thanks to the good folks at radioforall.net. And I'll be updating the page to make the podcast downloads a little more apparent. But that's coming. So I thank you for listening. And I guess, kids, in review, we went over today the possible coming draft. So keep an ear out for national service. Whenever you hear that, that means draft. Cheney's going to be taking the stand in the Plaingate case. The Good Shepherd opens today, the movie that purports to tell the history of the CIA. Sandy Berger, Clinton administration, National Security Advisor hid 9/11 documents. London braces for an attack. They say it'll be a miracle if it doesn't happen over the holidays. The Bush administration developing illegal bioterror weapons. Jeb Bush says he has no future. There's no money for the 9/11 workers. Robots are going to have rights in the future. The U.S. is building up their naval forces in the Gulf. And a nuclear bomb almost went off in Texas last year. A government oversight committee found. Iran dumps the dollar for the euro. The new e-passports that are coming out are completely hackable. And Moscow detained hundreds and hundreds of protesters. So there you have it. All the dirty news. MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com is where you can go for all the news. If you like the show, if you like the website, bookmark it, tell somebody about it, download the podcast, do it. Just for the love of God, do something. You can email me at MediaMonarchy@yahoo.com. So, I thank you for listening. Have a good holiday. Stay safe. My name's James. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.